I'm Michelle O'Donohue. Joining me today is my friend and colleague, Darren McGuire, who's a professor of medicine at UT Southwestern and arguably one of the world's leading experts on diabetes. So welcome, Darren.
Arguably, I guess. Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here, Michelle.
It'll be great to pick your brain on a few topics because, you know, historically we haven't really thought about diabetes meds as being the job of the cardiologist to prescribe.
Right.
But I think more and more that's where things are starting to shift. I mean, what are your thoughts about where we're going for this particular field?
Yeah, we're in a really dynamic time. And, you know, I've been interested in diabetes and cardiovascular disease for 20 years, and I've never managed blood glucose. It's not that I can't or I don't, you know, want to shunt it off to other people, but it just hasn't been in our domain as cardiologists because we haven't had clinical outcomes data. But now we have a number of clinical trials of anti-diabetes or anti-hyperglycemic therapies that have been proven superior for cardiovascular outcomes, and it's pretty clear across these trials that has nothing to do with blood glucose management. So we're kind of in a domain now, a little bit like the statins, where, you know, diabetes has a certain amount of cardiovascular risk, and there are therapies that have been developed for the treatment of hyperglycemia, but also have cardiovascular disease benefits that are independent of the glucose. And so we're going to have to start prescribing these. I already have. I mean, we have the class of medicines, the SGLT2 inhibitors, canagliflozin, empagliflozin, and dapagliflozin. And now we have cardiovascular outcome superiority for two of the three that are on the market. So empagliflozin and canagliflozin have both been shown to reduce cardiovascular risk. Empagliflozin has a clinical indication in the product label to reduce cardiovascular mortality. These are once daily tablets. They're pretty simple to prescribe. There's nothing to monitor. You don't have to titrate them. They're very well tolerated. There are a few side effects that we can talk about, but these are pretty simple meds to prescribe. Then we have this other class of injectable medications, the GLP-1 receptor agonists, and they're a little more challenging for the cardiologist. You have to have injection teaching, which we began to do. We've used that for years with low molecular weight heparins. We now are using PCSK9 inhibitors, so sometimes in our clinic we can teach patients to inject themselves. But for these GLP-1 receptor agonists, you tend to have to start a low dose, and titrate slowly for GI tolerability issues, and it's a little more complicated. But I think for the tablets, it's time to start prescribing them as cardiologists.
Yeah, no, I think you raised some great points there because I there might be some more reluctance on behalf of the cardiologist to start prescribing the injectables simply due to less familiarity. But I thought that one of the interesting points you raised is that it's not clear that A1C reduction is correlating with what we're seeing with cardiovascular benefit. And there seems to be a little bit of a divide, correct me if I'm wrong, but that the endocrinologists are still largely relying upon the A1C reduction when they think about their algorithm for how they're going to approach different diabetes medications, whereas I think the cardiologists are really looking at the cardiovascular benefit and saying, hey, shouldn't we be thinking about SGLT2 inhibitors, you know, if not first line, certainly near the top of the list of medications we should be prescribing for our diabetes patients.
That's exactly right. You know, in the cardiology space, we're using the risk of the patient instead of the glucose metrics to dictate or inform our clinical decisions. And you know, we've been doing that for years with statins, and it's a very similar paradigm. It's not that the glucose control is unimportant. And, you know, for microvascular disease risk reduction, we have a number of therapies that have been proven safe but not incrementally beneficial for cardiovascular disease. And that's actually a step forward, that we can at least have some confidence that some of these medications, like the DPP-4 inhibitors, these are also once-daily tablets. They have completely neutral effects on atherosclerotic cardiovascular outcomes, but they're very safe, robustly proven safety in non-inferiority trials, and so and they do improve the glucose control. And so the glucose control is a backdrop, and we can leave that to the endocrinologist. But even the American Diabetes Association now has slightly disconnected the indication for SGLT2 inhibitor empagliflozin and liraglutide, the once-daily injectable GLP-1 receptor agonist. So in the 2017 standards of care guidance from the ADA, they recommend to consider both of those medications independent of blood glucose for patients with atherosclerotic vascular disease and type 2 diabetes.
So you called out liraglutide specifically. Do you think that the cardiovascular benefit is a class effect for the GLP-1 agonist, or do you think it's restricted really just to liraglutide?
It's a difficult question. We always, you know, have the long history of trying to deduce class effects across ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, and here we are with another class of medication with somewhat different signals from the four different outcomes trials. And so pretty clearly, liraglutide improves cardiovascular outcomes, and in fact, it has a product label indication for reduction of cardiovascular risk that includes cardiovascular death, myocardial infarction, and stroke. And so it's the second medication in the history of diabetes now with a clinical outcomes indication. a similar drug that's given once weekly, semaglutide. These two drugs, liraglutide and semaglutide, are very similar to native GLP-1. The other medications in the class are quite different chemically, like exenatide ER. It's based on native GLP-1 receptor agonist, but its delivery system is a little bit different. Then we have a medication, lixisenatide. Those two medications have been shown to be safe but not incrementally beneficial. The point estimate for the large-scale outcomes trial with long-acting exenatide was in the favorable direction, barely missing statistical significance. So that's a little bit suggestive of a class effect, but we have pretty clear data with liraglutide and semaglutide, and I think those are probably going to rule the day, especially once we get to the once-weekly injectable. Patients really like that.
Right. So I guess broadly speaking, with the SGLT2 inhibitor class and the GLP-1 agonist class, if a cardiologist is watching this program today and is sort of entertaining the idea of prescribing one of these medications, do you have a way that you approach which one you'd prescribe preferably over the other as first line?
Certainly. So my choice right now is empagliflozin. I think canagliflozin data are pretty impressive. The problem with canagliflozin is there's a side effect that appears to be probably real, an incremental risk for amputation that comes with the canagliflozin. Also, empagliflozin robustly improved cardiovascular death. The analysis of the canagliflozin data, that component of the composite outcome wasn't statistically different, and the magnitude of the difference for cardiovascular death was about half of what was seen with empagliflozin. So if given a choice of modifying a 3-point MACE outcome or death, I'm going to go with death. The other point is empagliflozin comes in two doses, 10 and 25 milligrams. All of the benefit from a cardiovascular perspective is with the 10 milligram dose. So I don't see any reason for a cardiologist to use anything other than. So we only have to learn one dose. That makes it simple. We do have to remind patients about urinary hygiene, which I never thought when I went into cardiology I'd be having conversations with my patients about urinary hygiene. These medications, the SGLT2 inhibitors, do increase risk, 2- to 4-fold increased risk for mycotic genital urinary infections, yeast infections, and so you do have to counsel the patients about that. And then finally, and I think importantly, is we ask the patients not to take these medications on any day that they're not taking a normal amount of oral intake. And so if they're sick or have GI distress and they're not eating much, or if they're fasting for a procedure or fasting for religious purposes, if they're not eating and drinking, they shouldn't take the medicines on those days. And that has to do with a very small but consistent across the class risk for diabetic ketoacidosis, a pretty rare complication in type 2 diabetes, but it can be seen with these medications.
No, I think that's a lot of useful information, so thanks for that. You know, one of the topics that I've been hearing a lot of discussion about recently, and we have data now being presented for Canvas here at AHA, is regarding the question of whether there is any difference for prescribing, in terms of cardiovascular benefit, for prescribing these drugs, specifically SGLT2 inhibitors, for primary prevention or secondary prevention indication. Do you believe that there is a difference?
It's a great area of uncertainty. So, for example, of all adults with type 2 diabetes, only about 20% have prevalent atherosclerotic vascular disease. That's the patient population that's been predominantly studied in all of these outcomes trials. And there's reason to believe that the incremental cardiovascular benefit may be restricted to those patients with some level of underlying disease and risk. So, for example, the EMPA-REG outcome trial with empagliflozin was all of the patients had atherosclerotic vascular disease. In the CANVAS program, the two trials with canagliflozin, about 70% had prevalent atherosclerotic vascular disease. And it's in those subsets, in the trials that have enrolled both a primary and a secondary risk population, it's the subset with the atherosclerotic vascular disease prevalent that derives the benefit. Now, there's been sub-analyses and analyses of statistical interactions, and those have typically been negative statistically. But the reality is across these trials, if there's any benefit in the primary prevention realm, it's much more modest, and most of the time it's pretty neutral. And that includes the GLP-1 receptor agonist, so semaglutide and liraglutide. It includes canagliflozin. It also includes the long-acting insulin degludec that was compared against glargine. In all of these trials, the primary prevention subset really didn't have a demonstrable benefit. Now, these were small subsets, 20 to 30% of the patients, so the sample size was limited. And because it's a lower risk patient population, there were fewer events to analyze. So it just may be a matter of statistical power. It also may be a matter of the duration of observation for primary prevention. We may need to go 5 or even 10 years before we see these benefits. So it's uncertain. What I would say right now is what we know for certain is that it's the patients with atherosclerotic vascular disease. Both the indication in the product label for empagliflozin and for liraglutide both are predicated on prevalent atherosclerotic vascular disease for cardiovascular risk reduction.
No, I think that that's very helpful. I mean, certainly the patients with established CAD are going to have a higher risk of cardiovascular events. And I think the part that a lot of us have been grappling with is why should there be differential benefit per se? I mean, they might have a lower event rate if they haven't had a prior atherosclerotic event, but you might still think there'd be comparable benefit.
Right. And it's hard to understand how they may be differential. There are some hypotheses with the SGLT2 inhibitors that, you know, especially if you have underlying atherosclerotic vascular disease, you're more likely to have some kidney disease. And it looks like through the mechanism of their inhibition of glucose reuptake from the urine, there's a lot of secondary effects on sodium handling, on hematocrit, on circulating ketone bodies, and other things that are beneficial or at least more beneficial in patients with atherosclerotic vascular disease. So there is some reason to believe that may be a real differential treatment effect. But I would also turn it around and say that I am very confident that these are safe medications to use in patients without atherosclerotic vascular disease. And so if we go back to hanging on to the safety proof and understanding that long-term glucose control is beneficial, and these drugs are really easy to take for most people. The SGLT2 inhibitors and the GLP-1 receptor agonists result in some weight loss, so patients love that. A little bit of blood pressure reduction, favorable effects on lipids. And they're safe, even if we're not measurably impacting near-term cardiovascular risk. I think they're going to be very useful across the population.
Well, great. No, I think that really is a great point to wrap up the discussion. I think that, you know, it'll be very interesting to see over the next few years if there is really a shift in terms of the prescribing of diabetes medications towards the cardiologist. Right. But I think that the more that we can inform people so that they're familiar with the data, the better. So thank you for helping to provide clarity on
that
point.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me today, Darren.
All right. Great. Thanks, Michelle.